2012, January 6th. Today is the beginning of Unit 2, Five Revolutions in Astronomy 141, beginning with Lecture 4, The Copernican Revolution. So today we're going to begin Unit 2. We're really going to start getting into the guts of the course now, in which we're calling this unit Five Revolutions. It's a way of framing the entire topic that we're going to be talking about this quarter by showing that the idea of life on other worlds and our current way of turning that into a scientific inquiry actually rests upon five crucial scientific revolutions that have occurred over the last four centuries, most of which, in fact, have occurred over the last roughly century and a half, but have their roots in much, much deeper histories. So this is going to be a much more historical approach. We're going to look at the five major ways in which our view of the world and our view of the universe has changed in such a way that it now becomes sensible to address these questions of what is the nature of life, what are the nature of places, worlds other than our own, and could those worlds actually be habitable? Could those be places, refuges of life? So we want to explore, in turn, each of those five major cultural and intellectual revolutions that sets the stage for our current study. And nowhere better to begin, of course, is with the Copernican Revolution that asks the question, what is the place of the Earth in space? So today what we're going to be discussing is this Copernican Revolution that began more than 500 years ago. Modern science was born primarily out of an effort that occurred over many centuries to try to understand the motions of celestial bodies, the sun, moon, stars, and planets, but especially the planets. In order to understand those motions, we had to develop ways of measuring the sky, being able to describe those motions mathematically, and find a way to understand those mathematical descriptions in terms of basic physical principles. And that effort, which played out over at least 20 centuries from antiquity, led us inexorably to the modern view of modern physics, the modern view of the world that we possess today. And there were two competing models, two competing ways to describe the motion of the heavens that had been proposed over that period. We're going to meet, first of all, the most oldest of these, the geocentric or Earth-centered system. If you will, the most common sense model that one would form just by everyday observations. And finally, the more successful, and we now know more correct, heliocentric or sun-centered model, in which the Earth is but one of many planets circling the sun. Getting there was actually really hard, as we're going to see. It took a long time and took major changes in the way in which we viewed the world that have tremendous relevance to us today. But in particular, the final successes, as we're going to see, of this heliocentric model required not just simply better data, but it required advances in a philosophical outlook at the world that changed completely, and also crucial technological advances that moved us forward to inexorably point to this as the correct interpretation of the world. And we're going to see this. That's why I want to start with the Copernican Revolution, even though in many ways, okay, I'm an astronomer, I feel it's the most crucial, but it really, from Western science point of view, this is the crucial central revolution from which all others stem. Because we're going to see time and time again that major advances in many areas, be they chemistry, biology, geology, or astronomy and cosmology, have been driven forward not only by conceptual changes, but also because the time is right because of technological or technique changes that allow us to measure things or see things in a way that is different than before that changes our way of thinking. And so all of these together, as we go through the next five lectures, are going to lay the fundamental intellectual groundwork upon which our inquiry for the rest of the quarter is going to proceed. Now, let's start with the most basic point. This really has its fundamental basis in regular, good old observation. Naked eye, no instruments, stand out at night on a bright, moonless, clear night, and watch the motions in the heavens. And what we see, is, for the most part, is that the motions of celestial bodies are, for the most part, fairly regular and repeatable. We have the cycle of the years, we have the cycle of the months that are easily discernible. Our calendar that we use today is ancient. It's based upon the motions of the sun and the motions of the moon. For example, the stars appear to rise in the east, travel up to a maximum point, and then set in the west. And that's the same no matter where you stand on the planet. And it's regular, year after year, century after century. I can read descriptions of the stars at night from Homeric times, from 1000 BC, and recognize in those descriptions sufficiently that I know exactly which constellations they were looking at. And in fact, in a couple cases, I can tell you probably where you were on the Earth at what time of the year. That's how regular and repeatable the motions of the stars are. So when Homer references that Boötes is setting and the Pleiades are rising, I could tell you what time of year that is and which way he was probably facing or his character was facing when looking at the sky. That's how repeatable those motions are. Furthermore, the sun has regular motions. We rely upon that to define our day. The sun rises in the east and sets in the west. But it doesn't rise in exactly the same place. We're currently in a time now where the sun is spending more and more time in the sky. We've gone through the winter solstice around December 21st. The sun got to its furthest south, as visible from northern latitudes. It's going to continue to climb further and further north until just a week after the end of this course, around the 20th, 21st March, the sun will rise exactly at the eastern compass point and will continue to rise further and further into the northeast until we reach the summer solstice on the 21st of June, and then begin its motion back. So the sun not only rises in the east and sets in the west, but if we think about the stars that the sun is going to be moving against, it tends to move generally eastward circuit, making one complete circuit through the entire sky over the course of one full year. And so we not only get the day from the motions of the sun, but we get the year. The course of the seasons is written in these motions. But again, they're highly repeatable. You can literally build calendars and clocks upon them. The moon rises and sets daily, but it goes through a cycle of phases over the course of a lunar month. But it still makes this general eastward circuit relative to the stars. If you watch the moon, when the moon is first a crescent that appears near sunset, later on it's a half moon, but it's further east from where the sun has just set in the west. And finally, at full moon, the moon full moon rises in the east just as the sun is setting, and then goes in the opposite direction as the sun moon begins to get closer and closer to the sun, again, moving ever eastward through the sky until we see the moon beginning to approach the sun as the sun is rising in the morning. We're not going to get a lot of clear weather, but certainly you can watch and be sensible of that. One of my goals for these classes is always to get you kind of aware of what's going on in the sky, because you don't need instruments or much training to really follow what's going on. So these are fairly simple motions. They're cyclic. They're repeatable. They actually lend themselves to both sort of poetical as well as simple geometric description. The planets, on the other hand, break this mold. Now, generally, the planetary motions do seem to follow the basic pattern of rising in the east and setting in the west, and they sort of take on a kind of a generally eastward motion relative to the stars. But what differs from the planet is their speed of motion tends to change. But it changes in a very dramatic way. It will continue moving eastward, getting slower and slower night after night. This is a series of nightly photographs of the planet Mars taken in the year 2005-2006. And you'll notice the points get closer together here. That's because Mars is moving less over the course of night to night, until eventually it stops moving relative to the stars entirely. So east is to the right in this picture, left there, and suddenly starts moving backwards or westward, and then stops again, and then begins moving on its eastward track. This so-called backwards or retrograde motion is requiring an explanation. We need to know, why is it that the planets suddenly just don't simply rise in the east and set in the west? Why is their eastward motion relative to the stars so irregular and have this very particular pattern? And there's an additional clue. The middle of the retrograde track is when the planet is directly overhead at midnight, when the sun is on exactly this, for the planets like Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, is exactly on the other side of the Earth from us. If it was Venus and Mercury, then these times of retrograde motion, as they're called, occur when Venus and Mercury are on the same part of the sky. So there's very distinctive patterns, but it's very much more complicated. So complicated that it defies simple geometric or metaphorical description. You have to start using precision measurements. You have to start applying mathematics to describe it. And predicting these motions is very much more difficult. You could not build a calendar on the planets using the simple descriptions by which we build lunar or solar calendars. And so it presents us with a challenge, a very distinctive challenge. You've got to describe these motions. You can't just sweep them under the rug because they're right there in your face, night after night, century after century. How do we actually do that? Well, the oldest models that we know of, the oldest descriptions for the motions of the heavens are so-called geocentric models, and they held for more than 2,000 years. Now, this is a very widely assumed model. We see this over and over again. Here's a beautiful medieval woodcut of a geocentric type model. It's actually much more detailed. This is actually from Dante's Divine Comedy, although translated into English. What we see are the features of this are very common to all geocentric systems. There is a spherical Earth sitting at the center of the universe. The flat Earth idea didn't last very long. In fact, it was pretty much wiped out in about the 4th century in antiquity. People never really believed in the flat Earth. It never really re-arose. Maybe a slight revival during early Middle Ages, but no one took it serious. The spherical Earth is a very common feature of this. And it's smack at the middle, and it's the biggest thing in the universe. Outside of that, the very edge of the universe is the stars are all appear to be affixed to a celestial sphere. This, again, is kind of a common sense observation. The stars all appear to be exactly out of reach. There's no sensation of depth to the stars. They all appear equally far away, like they're affixed on the inside of an immense hemispherical bowl. In fact, many of our words for the heavens in many languages, in fact, are words for hemispherical bowls inverted over a flat or flat-ish Earth. But the stars are affixed to them as fixed lights. We just do not perceive depth, so they appear to be pasted on the sky. The sun, moon, and planets live in the realm between the Earth and this realm of fixed stars in the celestial sphere. Different details are brought into play. The moon is usually thought to be much closer than any of the other celestial bodies because we see it as a disk, and we see it go through changes. So it seems to belong to this realm of change. And then outside of that, in various orders, in this particular one, Mercury, Venus, the sun, then Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are arrayed on the sky. This ordering is not too terribly different. And in fact, this medieval picture, which Dante was using in his great book, the Divine Comedy, is a reflection of the state of knowledge, or the state of belief about the geocentric system in around the time that Dante was writing, in sort of the late Middle Ages. But this particular view, if not in detail, certainly in outline, would have been completely recognizable in 600 BC to Thales of Miletus and his students, to Aristotle and all of the others. The real basis, the real philosophical basis for the geocentric system that survived into late antiquity into the Middle Ages and Renaissance really comes to us primarily from Aristotle. He laid the basis, if not the details. What his principle was that the Earth was fixed and unmoving at the center of the universe, and that it was too big to move. And as a consequence, this included not only the Earth not moving as in moving around the sun, but it didn't even rotate on an axis. Now, this is kind of a common sense view of the world. We are right now moving at very fast speed eastward due to the rotation of the Earth around its axis, and we're hurtling at even more immense speeds around the sun on our orbit. Do you feel like you're moving? You don't. You're not sensitive to that motion because all your surroundings are moving with them. The physics of moving bodies makes you insensitive to that. We're only sensitive to motion if there's motion relative to our surroundings. But if all your surroundings are moving together, you don't sense it. So this common sense view that we are at rest, we are unmoving, has been translated into the entire Earth being unrest. And also there's another common sense view. Something really big is really hard to get moving, right? If I go around and push around the table, that's easy. If I wanted to try to push around the building, I'm going to hurt myself. The bigger an object is, the harder it gets moving. And what is bigger than the Earth in our experience? It's so immense that a single human being cannot even walk over its entire surface. Something that big is so unimaginably big, it must be unimaginably difficult to get it moving. And that was part of the reasoning behind Aristotle. However, the sun, moon, and planets and stars are very visibly moving. They rise in the east and they set in the west. The planets go through these very elaborate gyrations with retrograde motion, but they're in motion, and that's the whole point. So they must be smaller objects, they're self-luminous, that's why they shine. And Aristotle thought of these objects as being affixed to perfect crystalline spheres set into uniform circular motion, motion around their axes at an exactly uniform, even rate, no slowing up and speeding down. This is this idea that Aristotle wanted to put forward, the idea of perfection in the celestial realms. Now, how do you get the relatively imperfect-looking motion of the planets speeding up and slowing down through retrograde motion? And that's where life gets a little complicated. He had to basically make combinations of perfect circular motions, some forward, some backwards, that when brought in combination gave the appearance, and I'll underline the word appearance, of non-uniform motion. It was a compound motion produced of wheels within wheels. Each of those wheels themselves was finely tuned so that they, while in perfect circular motion themselves, the combination of the two can give speeding up and slowing down. We do know now that the Greeks did build certain fairly rudimentary and sometimes very sophisticated geared mechanisms, certainly around the 2nd and 3rd century BC. So the idea of being able to use compounds of circular motion to produce more complex motions was known to Aristotle and others. What this does is your attempt here is, do you believe that there is a physical structure involved? Maybe. Maybe that's part of the conception. But certainly you can represent the motions in terms of these perfect motions, and you can build up a geometric machinery to describe them. And so that's what people did pretty much in the time after Aristotle, who took this geocentric view seriously. They said the Earth is too big to move. It must be fixed and unmoving at the center of the solar universe, and that everything is moving out around it. Now, what I've drawn here is really the ultimate expression of the geocentric system that was formulated around the year 150 AD. What we're really talking about now is late antiquity, so late Roman Empire, before things started coming unglued about a century later, by an astronomer named Claudius Ptolemaeus, who was working in Alexandria. Alexandria is now in northern Egypt, but he was not an Egyptian, he was a Greek, and in fact, remember, Alexandria was a Greek town founded by the generals of Alexander the Great, hence its name. Ptolemy was building upon a tradition of astronomy that stretched back to Aristotle, incorporated observations of the sky by the Babylonians that were brought into the level of Greek knowledge by the conquests of Alexander the Great, among others, back in the 2nd century, 3rd century BC, and was built upon by various astronomers in the time between. If this was in Astronomy 161 or a general course on the solar system, we would spend a lot of time talking about the details of this history. But I really want to get to the bottom line. What Ptolemy did was he put together all of the mathematical machinery necessary, using of these wheels within wheels, in order to try to come up with a mechanical model, a system, for mathematically describing the motions in the heavens, including the detailed predictions of the motions of retrograde motion of the planets. That was the challenge. If you didn't get the planets right, your system was no good. It had to predict the motions of the planets. Now, there were lots of reasons why they wanted to predict the motions of the planets. Ptolemy is also known for having established one of the systems of astrology that, for better or worse, survives to this day. People cared about the positions of the planets because they were used as part of divination. And part of the divination, this may surprise you, was actually part of the medical practice of the time. So it actually kind of mattered. If you didn't have a good way to do your divination astrologically, you might not be able to treat your patients correctly and they might die on you. Of course, they're probably dying on you because you're leeching and bleeding them, but, you know, let's look that aside. You always got to find someone else to blame. So this geocentric model was very highly developed, and it was very accurate. It finely tuned all of these motions to give very accurate predictions. And so because it gave accurate predictions, people accepted it. So here I just want to show a little bit of the detail. How did Ptolemy and others explain retrograde motion? How do you get this stopping of motion, moving westward, backwards, and then stopping and moving eastward again? And the way Ptolemy did that was to basically build a system of circles upon circles. So the planet moves on a small circle called an epicycle, and that epicycle has its center on a much larger epicycle called a deferent, a big circle, which is centered in the simple version of this, is centered on the Earth. Now, there are various complications you can bring into play, like you can move the Earth slightly off center, you make it what's called an eccentric point, and you can play other kinds of games. But I'm going to leave that level of detail out. The idea is that the planet is turning upon this little circle, and then that whole circle is itself turning around the big circle. And so you get this compound motion of a wheel within a wheel. So sketched out, and I've, again, this is just a cartoon of this, we have the center of the deferent here. We've moved the Earth a little bit off center. This is pretty typical of some of these explanations. And then as the planet moves around this wheel turns, cog upon cog. And so you describe in three space this kind of loop-de-loop motion. So you move sort of eastward, stop, move westward for a while, stop, and then continue moving eastward. And if you fine-tune the size of the circles, the rate at which they turn upon each other, you can actually get it so that it will correctly predict when the planets will go retrograde, when Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn will go retrograde at their time when they're opposite the Sun. Now, there's lots of details here. Like, for example, this is not, they don't just do these individually. They're all tied together into a vast coupled system. You have to tie this all because it has to be relative to this epicycle here. When it goes retrograde, the Sun has to be down over here on the opposite side of the Earth. So you've actually got to now not just simply have wheels within wheels, but you've got to synchronize those wheels in detail. It was an immensely complicated set of calculational machinery. But it was so good at predicting the positions of the planets to the ability of people to observe, mostly with naked eye techniques, that it was to be the system for describing the heavens with only slight refinements for 1,400 years. People simply took it almost on a matter of faith. Because it works so well, why mess with it? Maybe slight modifications. The Arabs picked it up and made some modifications in the 9th century. People began to muck with it into the Middle Ages. But for the most part, the system of Ptolemy was the system of describing the motions of the heavens for 14 centuries. The other way of describing the motions of the heavens is to invert this geometry, to actually put the Sun and not the Earth at the center. And the Earth now becomes the third planet of this system of planets. Now, the naked eye planets at the time would be Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. If we make the Earth yet another planet, there are six planets, six wanderers about the Sun. And now we have a heliocentric system, a Sun-centered system. This is an alternative view, but it turns out to have some interesting advantages. It, too, was proposed relatively early. It was proposed around the 3rd century B.C. by a man named Aristarchus of Samos. At least that's the first version of this that comes down to us from antiquity. Samos is out in the eastern Mediterranean. A lot of the different ideas, the more unorthodox ideas in Greek philosophy, didn't come from the center of Greek philosophies in Athens and Alexandria. They came from the colonies, from the out places. And Samos is out actually near the Turkish coast in the modern Aegean. Aristarchus of Samos, we don't know his exact reasoning because his works have been lost to us except for a handful of works, one of which was a treatise on the distances of the Sun and Moon from the Earth. We know most of the details of the Aristarchan system through those people who were trying to debunk it later. But unfortunately, the vicissitudes of time... The ravages of time have basically led to his main work being lost to us in detail. But we can piece together from those who were arguing against him basically what his line of argument was. And it works a little bit like this. Using a geometric argument, if this is the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, if you watch the cycle of phases of the Moon, because the Sun is a finite distance away, the time between last quarter Moon to new Moon to first quarter will actually be a shorter time than the time from first quarter to full to last quarter, because the first and last quarter are not on perfect right angles to the Sun line, but on right angles in this triangle. And so if you measure the difference in time between last quarter and first quarter and compare it to first and last quarter, that difference in angles mathematically gives you one arm of the triangle, which lets you measure the distance to the Sun. It was a beautifully clever method. Unfortunately, given the crudeness of the methods available to him, he got the answer wrong by a factor of 40, as for the distance of the Earth to the Sun. But even then, with the size of the Sun, he was able to show that the Sun was actually vastly bigger than the Earth. So if Aristotle was to argue that the Earth could not be moving because it was so big, Aristarchus just showed geometrically that the Sun was even bigger. So why is it not an absurdity that the Sun is in motion but the Earth is not? Shouldn't the biggest thing in the solar system be the anchor of the solar system? And that was probably the physical reasoning behind Aristarchus' idea. Is taking the Aristotelian idea that the biggest object should be the hardest to move, the anchor is the Sun and not the Earth. He was able to show the Sun was vastly larger than anyone had imagined before by using this very clever geometry. His treatise on these distances survives, so we know his arguing reasoning very well here. What we don't know is how he constructed his heliocentric system. But it probably looks something like the picture I just showed. The other reason why a heliocentric system is very attractive philosophically is this problem of retrograde motion now has a natural explanation without having to have all of this immense gear work of wheels within wheels. Let's take a very simplified view of the Earth and Mars. With the Earth and Mars, the Earth is on an inner circle and is moving faster than Mars and will eventually catch up and pass it by. So when we're here at this position, we see Mars against the background stars at that position on the sky. But as we step forward and pass Mars by, we eventually pass Mars and it's now behind us. And the combination of seeing the moving Mars from the perspective of a moving Earth gives us this optical illusion of retrograde motion. So retrograde motion is not the planet actually physically stopping in its motion, going backwards for a while, stopping, and then physically moving forward. But it's an optical illusion of the fact that we are viewing the moving planet from a moving Earth. And just like if you're driving down the highway and if you're moving a little fast, you catch up on the traffic, the person appears to be driving backwards relative to you, but you're all moving forward at a relatively constant speed. You're just moving faster. And so the retrograde motion is simply a reflection of the differing speeds of motion of the planets around the sun. We are riding on the third of those planets, and so the complicating motions are we're seeing that compound. We're seeing our motion plus their motion is our observable. We cannot take this sort of God's eye view of the universe looking down upon this beautiful solar system rolling around the sun. We must view it from a moving Earth. And that makes life difficult, but not impossible. It means that underlying it, the beauty of the heliocentric system is the underlying true motions are simple. It's our perspective that makes them look complicated. So if you absolutely demand that the Earth is at the center of the solar system, you are inescapable that you must have a very complicated machinery to explain it. But once you free yourself, once you free the Earth from the center and set it into motion around the sun, the underlying explanation is simple, and the complexity is simply how you translate that into observations of a moving universe from a moving planet. Well, this idea was, in fact, as old as Aristotle, but it was discarded because the Ptolemaic system, the geometric systems, worked so well. So it was Nicholas Copernicus, who lived in the 15th and 16th centuries, at the beginning of the Renaissance, who really revived this idea of the heliocentric system. And so we call it the Copernican system as a consequence, because it was Copernicus who gave modern expression to the first really successful heliocentric description of the solar system. He wrote a very famous book in the year 1543 in Latin, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, on the revolutions of the heavenly orbs. It was one of the most revolutionary books in history because it tore the Earth from the center of the universe and set it in motion amongst the stars. Now, despite the fact that this was an overturning, a literal revolution in thought, both in its title and its effect, Copernicus was still very much an Aristotelian. He was still clinging to this idea of uniform circular motion and many aspects of Aristotle's descriptions of motion. Furthermore, in order to get all the details right, he actually introduced epicycles into his system. So you still had Mars on an epicycle riding on a deferent, but now the center of that deferent was not the Earth, but the Sun. So because he demanded uniform circular motion, motion at a uniform speed along its circle, he had to build a complex machinery to get the answer right, even though he had changed the perspective to a simpler heliocentric system. So within the conceptual simplicity, because he wasn't able to let go of this old idea of uniform circular motion, he built in tremendous complexity. But still, the idea got out. The idea that the sun, not the Earth, was at the center of the solar system, that a lot of the complexity of motion was due to the motion of the Earth around the sun with the other planets, but to make the details come out right, he had to add the machinery of epicycles. So it was like Copernicus, even though we see him as the scientific revolutionary, had one foot in the ancient world and one foot very tentatively stepping into the modern world. It was going to be to others to complete the Copernican Revolution. It was an idea which took fire in Europe. People really began to pay attention to this because the predictions of the Copernican system worked so well. And people began to see underneath it that the simplicity was showing a way forward to understanding the complexity, that maybe we didn't have to have all of these complex machinery. It suddenly was a path forward out of the past. The first person who really made the next step in the completing the Copernican Revolution was someone we met yesterday, the English astronomer and mathematician Thomas Diggs. It was Diggs who first brought to popular attention in England the Copernicus's book on De Revolutionibus. He wrote his own book in English describing the system. And it was Diggs who got rid of this idea that Copernicus had retained of the stars all being on a fixed celestial sphere at some very large distance from the outer edge of the solar system. By doing this, he recognized that buried in the Copernican system was an infinite universe. There was no fundamental bound on the size of the universe. It could be just very large, not necessarily infinite, but it was vastly bigger than the solar system. So by setting the stars not as affixed as points of light to some distant sphere, he actually opened up the possibility that those stars were at different distances from the sun. He gave space depth. And he actually thought that nearby stars were bright and more distant stars were dim. He thought maybe we'll take the stars as if they were all as bright as the sun, then the brighter stars are the ones that are closer and the dimmer stars are the ones that are further away. So that all the differences in brightness were simply a matter of depth and geometry. And eventually, there should be such distant stars that they would actually be too faint to see. So he was able to begin to imagine a universe which was bigger than we could actually see. Whereas to the Aristotelian world, everything you saw was all there is. That's why they called it the universe. It was everything. But now Diggs opened up the possibility that maybe we're only seeing a small bit. That's a beginning of the opening of the Western mind, the idea of opening to the possibilities of what it means to live in a heliocentric system was not simply about describing planetary motions, which is what the start was. It actually changed our view of what our place in the universe was and what the very nature of that universe was that went beyond the effort to simply predict planetary motions. This is one of the reasons why the idea really caught on, why it was so revolutionary. Beyond its immediate practical application, it pointed a way to a different way of looking at the world. The next person who really carried out part of the culmination of the Copernican Revolution is the brilliant mathematician and physicist Johannes Kepler, who lived in the generation following Copernicus. He took Copernicus's ideas much further. He was a brilliant mathematician. He was able to study tremendously better planetary data that was taken by his Danish mentor, Tycho Brahe, during the latter part of the 17th century. And he was noticed that the epicycles that Copernicus had to introduce into the system to get the motions right, this demand for uniform circular motion, was incorrect. If you will, where Thomas Diggs shattered the crystalline spheres, Kepler basically dismantled the epicycles. He dismantled all of this machinery that had been in the heavens for 1,500 years and replaced them with simple mathematical laws that describe the motions of the planets not as uniform motion along circles, but as motion along ellipses, in which their changes of speed and the shapes of their orbits were described geometrically. So there were natural descriptions for the change of speed rather than constant speeds in the heavens. Now again, if this had been a 161 type class, we'd have spent a whole lecture going over Kepler's laws. But what I really want to look at is the big picture here. What Kepler did was he gave mathematical expression to the motions in the heavens without understanding the physics, the whys of that motion, that eliminated the need for uniform circular motion, that eliminated the need for epicycles, but retained all of the other basic features of the heliocentric system of Copernicus. He basically got rid of the last vestiges of the ancient way of looking at it and opened up a new way of looking at the heavens. This was extremely important because it was Kepler's mathematical description that was to open the door a generation later to the physical description of these motions by Sir Isaac Newton and the rise of modern physics. But that's a different story for a different course. So Kepler's importance was he got rid of the last pieces of the machinery. And he did so, it was absolutely beautiful, because what was so beautiful about Kepler's laws, the mathematical laws, is they were far more simple to compute than having this massive machinery of wheels within wheels. It was very, very complicated. Really hard to do the calculations. Kepler's laws were really simple, easily expressed mathematically. So far so that he was able to come up with a series of star tables called the Rudolphine tables. They were named after the Holy Roman Emperor of the time, with whom Kepler was, in fact, the imperial mathematician later in his career. These tables were far more accurate than any other star tables, any other planetary tables that had come before them. So accurately that even though arguments over whether there was a heliocentric or geocentric system that were to rage somewhat dramatically over the next century among people actually working in astronomy, even within the Roman Catholic Church, who was one of the centers of opposition to Copernicus, used the Rudolphine tables because they worked so well. So practically speaking, the revolution had already gone out for the astronomers. It was sort of there for the rest of society to intellectually catch up. The next major player that really was part of the culmination of the Copernican Revolution is Galileo Galilei, one of my real heroes from this period. Galileo was also of that generation that followed Copernicus. He was a contemporary of Kepler, although he lived somewhat longer working in Italy. Galileo was certainly one of the first modern physicists, but what we're going to remember him primarily for in this course is as the person who took a brand new technology, the telescope, and applied it to astronomy and applied it to making observations of the heavens. Galileo himself did not invent the telescope. It was invented by Dutch spectacle makers working in around 1608, 1609 in Holland. But the idea was so simple that Galileo was able to reproduce it just from descriptions, teach himself optics, put them together, and was able to refine the design until he basically developed a long tube telescope that had about 30 power magnification, about like a good cheap pair of binoculars, although the image quality is nowhere as good as modern binoculars. But nonetheless, he started out trying to use this as a tool, for example, try to sell it to the Venetian Republic as a way to watch ships coming in. So if you were the first one to recognize a ship coming in, you could quickly get to the bourse to put down your money on betting on the particular shipment coming in and make a little money. They could be used in warfare to see your enemy ships coming from far off. But the Venetian Republic considered the idea so simple it figured out how to pirate it itself and told Galileo, thank you very much, but go away. So Galileo turned it to the sky. He was an infinitely curious person. And what he saw was in his book that he published in the year 1610, A Most Wonderful Sight. He began to see the heavens with completely new eyes. When he turned his telescope on the moon, what he found was that the moon, while it was considered to be a perfectly smooth, if somewhat discolored sphere by Aristotle, in fact had terrain. It had craters, it had mountains. Furthermore, he could measure the sizes of the shadows of these craters and could actually measure the depths of the craters and the heights of the mountains using geometry. So now all of a sudden the moon, this sort of boundary between the perfection of the heavens and the decay of the earth, had terrain like the earth. Now he didn't know whether it had water or weather, but it had terrain. It had imperfections. It was a place that you could imagine standing upon. When he didn't look directly at the sun, that would have caused him to go much more blind than he did prematurely, but in fact using a projection technique, the sun, which was so bright, so clean, and so perfect a system, the embodiment of perfection in the Aristotelian system, was imperfect. There were spots across its surface. Furthermore, these spots stayed in coherent patterns and rotated slowly from one side to another. The sun, which Aristotle said must be a perfect body, has imperfections on its surface, and it is in motion. It's rotating around its own axis on about a 50-day period. And Galileo was able to follow these patterns and show that they changed. The sunspot patterns came and went. This was a place with change upon it in the supposedly changeless heavens. When he turned to this planet Jupiter in the night sky, he got a tremendous surprise. First of all, Jupiter, which appears as a bright point of light to the naked eye, suddenly resolved into a disk. It was a sphere, just like the moon and the earth. And yet, accompanying it across the sky were four tiny points of light. They were moons. Moons circling Jupiter. Aristotle said the earth was the only center of motion, yet here was a center of motion that was not the earth. And it wasn't just a mathematical treatise. It wasn't some kind of philosophical idea. Anybody could make a telescope and see it for themselves. This was where the real revolution of Galileo came from. He wasn't just simply describing ideas. He was describing actual phenomena in the sky that anybody could observe, and people began to build telescopes and observe it for themselves. The real kicker, however, was to look at Venus. Again, Venus looks to our eye, our unaided eye, is a point of light in the sky that follows the sun about. But when you look at it through the telescope, and this is a sketch from Il Saggiatore taken a few years later, Venus goes through phases like the moon. So here's a modern set of photographs taken by Chris Proctor showing Venus going through its phases. The sizes here are also important. It's a really big crescent, but as it begins to become more and more full, more and more gibbous, it gets physically smaller. It's getting further away. So now not only do you have a sensation of the illumination of Venus by the sun, but you get a sensation of depth. And when you put it together, what you find is that the Copernican system, shown here on the left, Venus is but a planet circling the sun on an orbit that is closer than the Earth's. As Venus goes around the sun relative to the Earth, it should show a crescent phase, big because it's nearby, but as it goes to the other side, it gets further away, and therefore angularly smaller, but shows more and more of its face, a gibbous face. In the Ptolemaic system, Venus was following around an epicycle on a line between the sun and the Earth. And if you drew what the phases should be for the epicyclic prediction, it was just simply a projection of bigger and smaller crescents. This one observation showed that Venus must be circling the sun, not some mysterious point in between of the deferent. These were not themselves, individually or even collectively, did not disprove the geocentric system. But when you began to see the weight of evidence, describing them in a geocentric system became difficult and almost perverse, but in a heliocentric system, they had simple, natural explanations. And furthermore, these were not mathematical arguments among philosophers. Anybody could buy a telescope, look at the heavens, and see for themselves that we lived on a planet circling a star, surrounded by other planets, and we see a moving universe from a moving world. So the Copernican Revolution, and it was really closed by Isaac Newton, but again, another story for a different day. What the Copernican Revolution really is the most important piece for giving us our primary framework for understanding how the universe works. It tells us our place in the universe. We're not the center of the universe. Kind of a bummer. We always like to think the world revolves around us, but it doesn't. We're merely one planet of many around a relatively middle-sized star in a very, very vastly wide open universe. We do, another way of putting it is what we call the nowadays the Copernican principle, that we do not occupy a special or privileged place in the universe. Now that sounds like kind of a drag because it kind of brings us down, but it's actually important because it means as we study the Earth, as we study the physics of the Earth, the chemistry of the Earth and everything else, that means we're going to be discerning rules that should apply elsewhere in the universe. There's nothing about the Earth that makes us special except we happen to live here. And that's simply an accident of where we were born, rather than a fundamental physical principle that there's something special about Earth and life upon it. So it now means it becomes sensible to think about life on other worlds, but also means that if we study life on the Earth, if we study the Earth itself, it can actually inform our inquiry about what other worlds may be like, because as above, so below. The same rules up there apply down here and vice versa. Furthermore, what Newton and Kepler and all those working together found was that the universe and everything in it can be understood and its behavior predicted using a set of basic physical laws. By physical laws, I really mean physical rules, descriptions of the way matter and everything works. So if we can begin to understand how does matter work, how does life work, how does chemistry work, how do planets work, in other words, chemistry, biology, geology, we begin to discern the rules that will apply elsewhere. And the universe applies, these rules apply everywhere. This is a leap of, almost in many ways, almost a leap of faith. It's a belief that we can get out, I don't like to use the word belief, but certainly the idea that if we can discern the laws on the Earth, we can apply them elsewhere. This is an important idea because Aristotle thought there was a different realm, that the Earth was fundamentally different from the heavens, that the rules that were held in the heavens were different than the rules in the Earth. What Copernicus and all those who followed him did was to shatter that distinction and show that we are all part of one universe, obeying one set of rules. And it is up to us to try to discern what those rules are and learn how to apply them. And a lot of the other revolutions that we will discuss beginning into next week will look at how the Copernican Revolution opened up that world of ideas. Any questions? Okay, have a very good weekend. I will see you all on Monday.